I'm Anthony Rogers Wright. I am a national climate and racial justice advocate based in Seattle, Washington. I currently serve as the deputy director for Regenerate Nebraska, which is a small organization dedicated to transforming the industrial ag system to a regenerative model and increasing farmers and community systems and markets to facilitate that transformation. And then I also serve on the board of directors for the Center for Sustainable Economy, which is based out of Oregon, Portland, Oregon, and also board of directors for the Backbone Campaign, which is based on Vashon Island, Washington. So that's pretty much my spiel about who I am. The Center for Sustainable Economy is heavily policy-focused and solution-driven for effective policies and models to really expedite the transition from fossil fuels. So, you know, it's part think tank, part policy and part organizing. And it's a great smaller organization that's done a lot of work. They were part of the coalition that led and eventually won the fight to get ratified a fossil fuel moratorium in the city of Portland, Oregon. They're working on other models like fossil fuel response and also regenerative agroforestry. So they're amazing. And then the Backbone Campaign is just also a smaller organization who are probably most well known for kayaktivism, the whole Pacific
Oh, cool. North. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love you.
Yeah. Yeah. They're great. We're led by our amazing executive director, Bill Moyer, who also has projects like Solutionary Rail. And of course, they also host action camps to train residents and young people in direct action tactics, in art, disrupting powerful narratives with art, and a whole host of other aspects. So another great organization that really serves the community well.
You recently posted a really sort of mind-blowing thing on your Facebook feed. And what I'd like to do is actually read the preamble to it and then ask you to tell us about the gathering that spawned this piece of work and also help folks understand the content and really the potency of this declaration. This was actually the thing that got me to think, oh, it's time to interview Anthony, was seeing this and going, oh, I want to talk about this. So I'm going to go ahead and read the preamble. We, the people of color, gathered together in this multinational People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit to begin to build a national and international movement of all peoples of color to fight the destruction and taking of our lands and communities, do hereby reestablish our spiritual interdependence to the sacredness of our Mother Earth, to respect and celebrate each of our cultures, languages, and beliefs about the natural world and our roles in healing ourselves, to ensure environmental justice, to promote economic alternatives which would contribute to the development of environmentally safe livelihoods, and to secure our political, economic, and cultural liberation that has been denied for over 500 years of colonization and oppression, resulting in the poisoning of our communities and land and the genocide of our peoples, do affirm and adopt these principles of environmental justice. And then there's these 17 kick-ass environmental justice principles that go from there.
This was the first national People of Color Leadership Summit, which I believe took place in New York City. And that happened between October 24th and October 27th in 1991. And I was a first-year student in high school at that point. So I would say that, like, while I had certain ideas that I was still formulating in my mind, I was 14, about there being a difference in, you know, communities of color with even just the physical and visible natural environment versus, you know, the communities of many of my white friends, you know, on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I'd known that, but I certainly was not as versed to the extent of this amazing document, which is known as the Principles of Environmental Justice. By 1991, you know, we had, what I do know is that we had plenty of evidence which demonstrated what's sometimes referred to as environmental racism, which is a term that was coined by Dr. Benjamin Chavis with the United Church of Christ, who in 87 commissioned a report called Toxic Waste and Race. And the conclusions of that report included a demonstration of the fact that race, more than income or class, had more to do with where pollutive industries were situated than your income. So we knew at this point that facilities like coal-fired power plants, pipelines, refineries, freeways, all tended to be located disproportionately in communities of color, specifically African American, Latinx, and Native American. So, you know, we had a wealth of evidence by 1991, and you know, it was sort of, I believe that the point of this leadership summit was to discuss what they were going to do with this information, with this science, you know, and how they were going to turn it, or at least create the steps to turn it into some policy, and came together and eventually came up with the document. It's really revolutionary, right, in the history of environmental awareness and stewardship and activism, because in 1991, you know, you see that we're using phrases like reparations straight up. You know, there's no perambulation, and self-determination for Native American people are also straight up just used, and it's something that we really haven't seen until recently, right? 25 years later, two decades later, there are young people who are involved in climate activism right now, like the Sunrise Movement, Historically Black Colleges and Universities, and Climate Change Initiative, Climate Justice Alliance, and other frontline young people who, you know, were just born when this Principles of Environmental Justice came out, and only now are we really starting to increase the use of a lot of these paradigms in the environmental lexicon. So just truly epochal and truly groundbreaking.
What's your sense of what the declaration did internally for communities of color in terms of thinking of yourselves as activists and, you know, sort of coalescing that thought about environmental justice being like a real thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very easy to internalize because, I mean, these people were experiencing the impacts directly, acutely, and chronically, right? So, I mean, it really is sort of the you're seeing the difference right there with your question between, you know, climate justice activists and environmental activists, right? Climate justice activists are all about the front lines. They are literally fighting for immediate survival. They are witnessing disproportionate health impacts in their children, specifically with cardiovascular diseases like asthma, bronchitis, and in their elderly populations, angina, bronchitis, and other health ailments. And then, of course, increased incidences of cancer in places like Cancer Alley, which is in the Gulf South, as well. And of course, incidence of cancer in indigenous communities in Arizona, where they are situated near coal-fired power plants and their water is heavily tainted by uranium mining. So it was already, I think, primordially internalized, because this declaration is really a continuation of, you know, a call for liberation from years and centuries of colonization, right? The preamble even kind of evokes that this is a struggle that's been happening since African slaves were stolen and brought to this hemisphere in Haiti, and eventually the lands now known today as North America and Virginia, right? We're about to actually celebrate the 400, I don't know if we should call it an anniversary, but 400 years the first slaves arrived in Jamestown. So very easy to internalize, axiomatic almost, because it's just another pillar of oppression and white supremacy and racialized capitalism, where people at the bottom of the rung are experiencing the worst of the impacts.
Got it. Nice. So what I'm hearing in that is that this was really a declaration. It's like this was the reality that people of color were experiencing in the United States around, you know, environmental issues and climate issues. And this was just sort of going like, here's what we're experiencing and here's where we want to go with it and the remedies that we see. And so it wasn't so much a, sounds like it maybe wasn't as revelatory for a lot of people of color as maybe it is for white people, because y'all were already experiencing a lot of this. Yeah.
I mean, yes. I mean, but I do also think it was revelatory for you know, people of color as well, because I mean, it's sort of like when communities see their leaders taking a stand, you know, it inspires them to get involved with the fight as well. Because I mean, you know, while you know, these communities of color were experiencing these impacts, they might not have had, you know, direct scientific evidence and statistical evidence that they were purposely and assiduously and intentionally being selected, their communities anyway, as sacrifice zones. So once that, like, this basically is a continuation of that revelation of the science and the statistics to say, hey, you know, everyone, but especially people of color, you know, stand up, rise up, because you're being poisoned. Your children are being poisoned. You're being killed off, you know, and essentially you're being oppressed.
Do you have a sense of what you think the best role is for white people in this? Is it, you know, I mean, it feels to me like there's an element of like getting super active on the one hand and getting out of the way on the other hand. And I'm not entirely sure where that balance is, but I know that you think a lot about racial dynamics within movement spaces, and so I'm curious if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a very Byzantine, but at the same time imperative issue that we have to continuously struggle with in you know, the climate community, because we still haven't gotten it right yet, and it results in a lot of extra work for repairing relationships. Rather than, you know, the just necessary work to repair the planet and repair each other in the process. I think that we're getting better at recognizing that there's some social location issues that have to deal with race, ethnicity, ableism, you know, people who are trans, LGBTQIA. Also, there are all these dynamics that have to be considered in our equation of how we eventually become a movement of movement. So there's internal work, there's introspection that needs to be done. I think that balance is that you were questioning. Yet again, we you know, one of the answers that I can offer for that is that we've once again seen frontline leadership, in this case in the form of the Hamas Principles for Democratic Organizing, which was created after a meeting with the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice in Jemez, New Mexico, in December of 1996. And, you know, it's a pretty simple set of six principles that include aspects like let people speak for themselves, ensuring that relevant voices of people directly impacted and affected are heard, right? And, you know, working together in solidarity and mutuality is another of the Hamas principles, as is be inclusive and building just relationships among ourselves. So I think that there are great resources. They just need to be applied and they need to be implemented, not just discussed. I mean, you will hear the phrase Hamas principles mentioned a lot in climate spaces at, you know, at conferences and, you know, at retreats, and then they'll be put up on a wall for people to see. But what hasn't been discussed is the praxis of the Hamas principles. You know, they aren't just words, they are an invitation, but you still have to practice them. You can't just say them. You know, this is lived reality. Not meant to just be, you know, used rhetorically, right? The Hamas principles for democratic organizing maybe even needs to be amended to be called the Hamas practices for democratic organizing, you know, because for the people in the back who haven't seemed to have been able to grasp what the principles are really evoking. So I think that you know, this would help to build that balance. But certainly not white people shouldn't get out of the way. I mean, white people are being impacted by this climate crisis in some cases as much as frontline communities. There are certainly poor, working class white communities that are experiencing the impacts of mountaintop removal, of water contamination as well. So there's obviously space for them in this fight. It's just understanding when too much space is being taken up. I think that that there's some work for white people to do with recognizing racial dynamics, recognizing, you know, white fragility and whatnot as well. So this is something that's ongoing. I think that we have certainly gotten better, but I also think that we're a ways from where we need to be.
So you and I met originally on an interview. We both got tagged by, I think it was Jamaican National Radio. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
So we had this little interview and it was like 5 o'clock in the morning my time and 4 o'clock in the morning your time or something, like super early. And so I'm not sure I actually remember it that clearly, but there was this sort of weird moment for me in that interview where they asked, so we're being interviewed, I think it was three Jamaican women who were interviewing us, and at one point one of them asked us, like, well, so what do you think Jamaicans should be doing about climate change or something like that? And that moment has stuck with me, partly because, like, my initial response was, my God, why are you asking us? Like, Americans have, like, so fucked this up. And for whatever reason, it has stuck out in my mind. And I've realized that part of my, like, oh my God, don't ask us question was really a don't ask me question as a white person. And I've wondered, like, how different is it? How different was that moment for you?
I definitely remember that. And, and I think that actually one of the things that I had recommended was to really get control of their agricultural system, which Jamaica kind of does. Like, the government has been helping people to, create community gardens and personal gardens. And if that agriculture is done in a sustainable way, like regenerative ag practices, Jamaica would be doing, a ton for the climate crisis, or just to address the climate crisis, I should say. So that's one. I think that it's really, really hard, to hear a question from any island nation, what should they be doing about climate change? Because they really didn't have, especially, nations like Jamaica, didn't really have a hand in creating this crisis, but they are on the front lines of the impacts of this crisis. I mean, rising sea levels will have just wreak havoc in Jamaica and have nearly irreparable impacts and consequences. So that's where it hit me. You shouldn't have to ask this question, Jamaica. It's really incumbent upon countries like the United States, who, despite having 5% of the population, are responsible for 20% of, global greenhouse gas emissions. That's a question for us. They should flip Kennedy's question around, altogether. Jamaica has every right to be asking more industrialized nation, what are you going to do for us? Because you have put us in a really impossible position, right, through your avarice and your hyper-capitalist model. And it's, like, for instance, one of the initial reasons why Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua did not sign the Paris Climate Accord, because, he thought it was ludicrous that Nicaragua, was being held as responsible as the United States and Western Europe, and sort of like, here we are, a small so-called developing nation in Central America, where, now they're at almost 70% renewable energy, and we're going to have to pay into a global, fund for something we didn't create and that we're actually pushing to address faster than you are. I don't agree with Ortega on some things he's been doing recently, but in that sense, I definitely agreed with that syllogism. So that's really how it impacted me, you know, more just sort of as someone who lives in a nation that is way more responsible for this global crisis than a small island nation like Jamaica.
Let's talk electoral politics a little bit. So you worked last fall on an electoral campaign, and I'm curious if you want to share with some folks, you know, why you decided to do an electoral campaign and how that went and what you sort of see as the balance between electoral work and the other forms of activism that you're involved with.
Yeah, so in 2016, I was a policy advisor and surrogate for, you know, Senator Bernie Sanders. That was a great experience. And I've worked on other campaigns since, and always, you know, like tomorrow, or actually Friday, for instance, I have a meeting with Governor Jay Inslee here in Seattle. I think that it's very, very important to have an inside and an outside game. You know, there are things that need to be done on the outside to the pillars of power, and there's the things that need to be done on the inside as well to dismantle pillars of power that are not serving the majority of the people mutually. And I think that policy, there's a major place for policy in how we address the climate crisis. Green New Deal, of course, being an example of that. Recently, Bernie Sanders's climate change platform was one of the best in political electoral history, for sure. We need policies in place that are going to assist the initiatives that we need to take, to fund the initiatives that we need to take to avert and become more climate resilient. I just think there's nothing that's mutually exclusive of, you know, bringing activism to electoral work and also doing, you know, things like direct action and whatever else it is art, you know, that you bring to the climate fight. That's really, you know, how I see it myself. It's just very, very important that we have people in place in our government, especially at the local level, who are going to implement policies that avert but address the climate crisis and get us more prepared to deal with, you know, inevitable climate consequences that come from a very tainted atmosphere right now. Real work usually comes like after the policy is passed, because then, you know, we have to implement a lot of maintenance to make sure that the policies are operating in the way that they are meant to be, and making sure that there's an equitable distribution of the benefits of that policy as well. So there's still a lot of organizing and activism that takes place after a policy is passed, right? Like the Voting Rights Act was passed and since has mostly rescinded, but that didn't stop us from, you know, massive initiatives to register people to vote, right? There's still work that needs to be done. So I see it like that as an analogy to when climate policy is passed, we're going to have to do the same amount of work.
So I've been seeing kind of mixed reviews of the Green New Deal. You know, a lot of people excited that it like seems like it's actually serious, which is refreshing from anybody in the U.S. government. But also a lot of criticisms about, you know, not taking indigenous rights seriously enough and that kind of stuff. Do you have any like general comments that you can make at this point?
I mean, I think that it's a bold vision and, you know, that should be certainly lauded. I share the concerns of groups like the Indigenous Environmental Network, Climate Justice Alliance, Food and Water Watch also recently expressed some concerns with the lack of language that explicitly, deals with fossil fuels and nuclear energy, you know, what is meant by net zero emissions. So, you know, there are some holes and there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. I think also just, you know, there seems to be a lack of actual plan to turn this into policy. And I think that might have just gotten turned on its head with the announcement today. As a matter of fact, that Senate Majority Leader and Republican Mitch McConnell is actually going to call the resolution up for a vote. So I think that was on his part, a pretty good move politically, because it has implications for 2020, and it puts the framers of the Green New Deal on the defensive a bit, right? Because if there are some Democrats that vote against it, that could create more infighting in the Democratic Party, which bodes well for Mitch McConnell, of course, and I think he's trying to do that. He's trying to expose vulnerable senators who are running in 2020, like Doug Jones, who, you know, will be forced to fight pretty hard to keep that seat in Alabama that he won in extraordinary fashion in the hands of the Democrats. How's he going to vote on it? So, I mean, it rattles the cages a bit. And then, of course, you have some Senate members of the Senate who have already announced that they're running for president. I believe four, right? Harris, Booker, Warren, I'm missing one, but Klobuchar. So there's five presidential candidates who are going to be forced to vote on this as well, and that could also be used as fodder against them by the sitting president and beyond in 2020. So I think that, you know, that lack of planning and being, it seems, more concerned with the pomp and circumstance might come back to bite us a bit and force us to get pretty pretty innovative of how we're going to approach this pending vote, it looks like. So I have some concerns about that. And then, you know, finally, I would say, you know, it's just really a matter of making sure that frontline groups are at the table through all facets of, you know, the process. That was a bit shaky in the initial rollout of the Green New Deal, as expressed by Climate Justice Alliance and other frontline leaders. So it's very imperative that we're not just considering the voices of frontline leadership and frontline communities, but that their voices are leading voices in any process that actually becomes policy. So, you know, I mean, you know, we have to also make sure that it doesn't get co-opted, right? Because the lack of actual policy language, for instance, in, you know, everyone in their parent is coming up with their version of the Green New Deal, right? So, Cuomo in New York, Andrew Cuomo, the governor, released a version that he's referring to, the New York State Green New Deal, and it, you know, includes provisions that would allow for the use of nuclear energy, for instance. So, you know, that's a problem. And then we have to make sure also, I would say, that the Green New Deal is not being abused as a fundraising and list-serving tool for candidates or organizations, that it's actually going to be used as an organizing tool that brings and unleashes the power of grassroots organizing, rather than allowing grass tops to use it to suit their personal needs and, you know, the greater good. All right. Thank you so much for giving me some of your time, and take care.
All right. Take care, Anthony. Thanks. Bye-bye.